Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Don't worry. I won't hurt you. I only want you to have some fun.
Dearly beloved.
Yes, come ride your bike and dance the night away on Friday, June 7th at 8 p.m. as we celebrate Prince's birthday with a mobile bicycle dance party. Roll around Portland with Diablo as we rock Pedalpalooza, dropping the Prince jams all night long, stopping to dance along the way. Again, that's Prince's birthday celebration on Friday, June 7th at 8 p.m., beginning at his mural on 42nd and Prescott. More information can be found on the KBOO website under Community Events.
The time is 5:01 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the state mental hospital is in crisis.
The Warm Springs Reservation is in the second week of a boil water notice.
And the Oregon hate crimes legislation is not dead in the state legislature.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 7th, 2019. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Linda Olson-Osterland. A bill in the Oregon legislature today would strengthen Oregon's law on hate crimes. Currently, first-degree hate offenses must involve two or more people, and acts motivated by the perception of a person's gender identity can't be charged as hate crimes. In contrast to crimes motivated by race, religion, sexual orientation, disability status, or country of origin, Senate Bill 577 would rewrite large portions of a criminal code that was created in 1981 in order to combat the rise of skinhead gangs across Oregon. The Department of Justice would hire a hate crimes response coordinator and monitor a new crisis phone line for victims. The father of hate crime victim Lornell Bruce spoke in favor of the hate crime bill this week.
Oregon. My son died in 2016 from a hate crime. When he died, it really ruined our family in a horrible way. The sentencing was passed not too long ago for the murderer, but I don't believe the sentencing fit the crime. I believe that my son was cheated out of more time of his life than the killer would have gotten or have gotten in his sentencing. If SB 577 was in effect, my son's murderer would have gotten a felony charge for a hate crime. 20 years instead, he received 18 months for a hate crime with the chance of free time or good time with that. SB 577 would shield future hate crime victims and maybe give them some hope that the next perpetrator would think twice before he was to commit that type of crime. I believe that my son's murderer is, and his sentencing is definitely a product of an outdated system.
That was Larnell Bruce Sr., the father of hate crime victim Larnell Bruce, speaking this week in favor of hate crime legislation, Senate Bill 577 down in Oregon.
Oregon Health Authority Director Patrick Allen says the state mental hospital is overcrowded because too many mentally ill people are being brought in for treatment so they can stand trial for misdemeanors relating to homelessness. About 60% are homeless, according to state figures. In a letter to Governor Kate Brown today, Allen admitted the facility is overcrowded because of the demand for what is called, quote, trial fitness treatment. The Oregonian reported today that the number of mentally ill defendants needing trial fitness treatment has doubled since 2012. Allen also issued directives intended to slow the flood of defendants to the psychiatric hospital in Salem. In a statement today, Governor Brown said problems at the mental hospital will not let up until policymakers stop, quote, criminalizing the homeless and mentally ill. The governor also said, quote, I urge the legislature to approve funding during this session to expand housing and mental health treatment at the local level to get people off the streets and into safe and stable homes.
A water crisis in the town of Warm Springs continues with schools, businesses, and homeowners in their second week of a boil water notice. The Bend Bulletin reports that a series of water issues impacting the Warm Springs Indian Reservation since May 30th is due to loss of pressure in the distribution system. Officials say they have no idea how long it will last. The Tribal Council was expected to address the issue in meetings earlier this week, but results have not been announced. Warm Springs is one of Oregon's poorest communities, with poverty rates double the state average. The community has endured four similar boil water notices in the past 6 months because aging infrastructure and lack of funding are blocking repairs to the water distribution network. The current problem is the result of a main line break, and the cost of the repair is not known, according to tribal officials. About 1,200 water services connections have been affected in the community of 3,800 people.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator. Tonight's weather, showers and lows around 50 degrees, and tomorrow's weather sunny with some clouds and highs around 70. And today in history, Mohandas Mahatma Gandhi launched his first act of civil disobedience, refusing to leave a first-class train compartment in Maritzburg, Natal Province. He refused and was thrown off the train with his baggage. Now, our quote of the day is from author Shannon Alder. Don't say you don't have enough time or enough money to change the world. You have exactly the same number of hours per day that were given to Helen Keller, Gandhi, Michelangelo, Mother Teresa, Leonardo da Vinci, and Jesus Christ.
The Trump administration plans to cancel English classes, recreational activities, and legal aid for unaccompanied minors staying in the federal immigrant shelters nationwide. The administration made the announcement Wednesday, citing the immigration surge at the southern border is causing budget strain. U.S. Border Patrol has detained more than 132,000 people at the border last month alone, 11,000 of them being unaccompanied minors. The administration told Congress the migrant shelter program could run out of money by late June. They have asked Congress for $2.9 billion in emergency funding to expand shelters and care. Critics of the plan say costs have driven up because children are being held for extended periods of time due to rigorous government standards of sponsors. Mary Meg McCarthy, executive director of the National Immigrant Justice Center, says she fears the cuts are an effort to pressure Congress into funding the administration's broader immigration agenda. Advocates for migrant children say the move to cut these services are potentially illegal under the 1997 Flores Agreement, which established standards for the treatment of migrant children held in government facilities. Also standing in opposition, the 2013 Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act, which further defines standards of care for children in federal custody and guarantees legal counsel to them. Rochelle Garza, a staff attorney with the ACLU of Texas, says without these services, the detained children will be, quote, prison-like conditions, end quote, and we will see more children in court with no legal representation.
Congress this week took up some important topics in digital security and personal privacy. Esther Everam from On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital, has a story.
In the cyber realm, other news from D.C. this week addressed issues of privacy and data. At a Tuesday hearing of the House Oversight and Reform Committee, representatives from several federal agencies, including the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security, testified that even though facial recognition software is still in the development phase and is particularly flawed in recognizing people of color and women, it is being utilized throughout federal law enforcement and safety agencies. Representative Rashida Tlaib of Michigan expressed alarm that such technologies are being used to increase surveillance in her district.
I got to tell you, and through the chairman, I hope this is okay. This stuff freaks me out. I'm a little freaked out by facial recognition, Mr. Chairman. I hope that's okay. I can say
that. Yeah,
that's
okay.
Thank you. My residents in Michigan's 13th congressional district have been subjected to increased surveillance and over-policing for decades. Currently, the city of Detroit rolled out real-time video surveillance program called the Project Greenlight in 2016 to monitor crime at late-night businesses like gas stations and liquor stores. But now the system has expanded to over 500 locations, including parks, churches, schools, women's clinics, addiction treatment centers, and now public housing buildings. Without notice or public comments from residents, the Detroit Police Department added facial recognition technology to the Project Greenlight, which means Detroit Police Department has the ability to locate anyone who has a Michigan driver's license or an arrest record in real time using video cameras mounted across the city in a database of over 50 million photos.
In response to a question from Representative Tlaib, Kimberly Del Greco, a deputy assistant director at the FBI, said that the agency does not have a contract with Amazon for the facial recognition software being used in Detroit. Committee Chair Representative Elijah Cummings of Maryland said another hearing on facial recognition technology will be held to discuss the protection of privacy. Well, it seems that social justice organizations have been ahead of Congress in recognizing possible cyber threats to privacy and human rights. On Wednesday, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, or EPIC, held a conference on AI, or artificial intelligence, and human rights, the future of AI policy in the U.S. And on Saturday, June 8th, the organization Defending Rights in Dissent is hosting the program Stop Spying, the FBI Surveillance of Black and Muslim Communities at the David A. Clark School of Law at the University of the District of Columbia.
The U.S. Senate today introduced the International Climate Accountability Act, which would put the U.S. back into the Paris Climate Accord. Senate Bill 1743 is a companion bill to the House Climate Action Now Act passed by the bipartisan majority last month. The legislation would ensure that the United States meets its international commitment to cut carbon emissions by at least 26% by 2025. It also calls for a strategic plan from the Trump administration to meet the goals and defunds any effort to quit the agreement.
In Luxembourg today, a massive sit-down strike took place at the headquarters of the European Investment Bank. 70 protesters locked down in front of the entrance to the bank, demanding an immediate end to the bank's financial support of fossil fuel projects around the world. This is the first time that the European Investment Bank's head office has ever been directly targeted and disrupted in this way. This action is taking place just 1 week before the 28 EU finance ministers, the bank's board of governors, will be holding meetings to review the bank's energy lending policies.
Donald Trump's 5% tariff on Mexican goods is set to go into effect on Monday. And the heads of the U.S. farm industry groups say farmers across the country are bracing for the impact of the tariff. The U.S. exported $19 billion in agricultural exports to Mexico last year, making it the second largest purchaser after Canada, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Mexico is the top market for U.S. corn, rice, dairy products, poultry, eggs, pecans, and also a major buyer of American beef, pork, soybeans, and wheat. A trade war with Mexico could potentially cost U.S. producers billions of dollars.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news issues and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Montana Attorney General Tim Fox appointed members to the Missing Indigenous Persons Task Force on Thursday. The move follows the recent passage of legislation to create the task force. It includes a representative from each of Montana's seven reservations and the Little Shell Tribe. It also includes a member from the Attorney General's Office and the Highway Patrol. The group will work to identify barriers and seek ways to improve collaboration and reporting and investigating cases of missing Indigenous people. The first meeting is scheduled to take place Tuesday. The following day, a state and federal training is planned for law enforcement and the public. Topics include how to report a missing person, human trafficking, and the use of alerts and advisories. Northern Cheyenne leaders in Montana and their partners are striving to find solutions to address unemployment. Olivia Reingold has more.
People gather outside the tribal building lawn on a sunny Tuesday in Lame Deer. They're signing up for a work lottery. Three times a week, people will be randomly selected for daily job opportunities. For $9 an hour, participants can do things like work in a community garden or help clean up trash.
I'm so happy.
Some people, like Teresa Magdalene Crazy Mule Wounded Eye, have been without work for a while now.
You know, I have grandchildren that I like to go forward and continue to provide and basically just get back up on my feet. So.
She's one of more than 40 people who signed up for the program. As a whole, the country is experiencing high unemployment rates, but that's not the case in Lame Deer. This year, the unemployment rate on the reservation has ranged from 11 to 16%. That's according to Montana's Department of Labor. Compare that to the state average, which hasn't budged above 5%. Charlene Alden says unemployment on the reservation can be driven up by work requirements, like taking a drug test or having to have a driver's license.
It's so cumbersome.
Alden directs the tribe's Department of Environmental Protection. The Let's All Work Together program was her idea.
We're not making it real hard or difficult. You don't have to have a driver's license. You don't have to have a high school diploma. You don't have to have any degrees.
It starts with a one-page application. Manape Elkshoulder just filled his out, and he's hoping that when the program launches next week, he'll be one of the lucky 10 selected to work.
Because I'm unemployed at the moment right now, you know, so it's like anything would do right now.
He used to do construction, but was laid off about 4 months ago. Recently, he's been coming to downtown Lame Deer to sign up for every job he can find.
Try and aim for something that I can ride on or something, you know, get my life going.
Next Tuesday might be his shot. That's when the program is set to launch. Kayla DeRoche contributed to reporting for this piece. I'm Olivia Reingold with Yellowstone Public Radio News and Report for America.
Chairman Harold Frazier of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe says the fight against the Keystone XL pipeline will continue after a federal appeals court tossed a challenge to block construction Thursday, but other challenges still remain. Frazier said in a statement the pipeline is slated to cross hundreds of miles across treaty territories that the U.S. has pledged to protect, adding the federal government has failed his people and land. The Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, the Rosebud Sioux Tribe, along with environmental groups, are fighting construction. In recent public hearings held by the Rosebud Sioux Tribe in South Dakota, opponents testified if legal battles fail, there will be another protest similar to Standing Rock. The company, TC Energy, recently announced it has lost the 2019 construction season due to court delays. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
It's First Friday, and tonight from 6 to 9 p.m., KBOO is hosting an art reception as part of the neighborhood celebration. Come down in person to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue and check out the art, enjoy a glass of wine or cider, live music, and tour the station. Right now, we're joined by Amy Kutab and Justin Auld, our featured artists tonight at the KBOO art reception. Welcome to KBOO Community Studios.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks for having us. We're totally psyched.
We're very psyched to have you here. Talk about your art tonight. How would you describe your show that's hanging here at the studio? Amy, you can go first.
These are chapter breaks from paintings that are for a book I'm working on with my dad regarding his life growing up in Palestine and my life growing up in the United States.
And Justin, talk about, you know, the series of paintings. They're just beautiful. They kind of remind me of Monet with your style. What is your medium and what is pareidolia?
Yeah, so I work in oil paint on panels mostly. And the whole idea, what I'm trying to mine is just that that moment when you try to, you see something in a random pattern. Mm-hmm. And like where your brain goes with that. And like, it kind of, for me, distills down to our relationship to our natural world. So the paintings explore that. Like, what are you seeing? And is that what I'm seeing? Basically.
Now I'm curious about how you came to art as a calling. Amy, do you want to tell us about how you came to this project, really, that's with your father?
Yeah. I hadn't explored my dad's background very much. He told me a lot about where he grew up when I was a kid. And of course it came up in conversation a lot, but I had sort of tried to avoid thinking about it and tried to avoid worrying about the conflict and tried to assimilate into American culture as much as possible. But at some point, a few years ago, it became really hard to avoid wanting to explore that. And so we decided to make a book.
Yeah. So well, this is the Palestinian side of you. When you say you decided to make a book, were you already an artist who could illustrate a book or who could, is it written by in hand? Is there handwriting we get to see in the chapter book?
It's a graphic novel, and there'll be some of his handwritten notes, my dad's handwritten notes, but and all of the text is handwritten by me. But yeah, I've been doing illustration for many years, and since I was a kid, of course.
Cool, thanks.
Yeah.
Justin, many folks know you not just from your artwork, but also you're pretty famous as a bluegrass musician as well. So
I would not say that.
How did you decide to dedicate? You know, I've heard quite a few people talk about you about this. How did you decide to dedicate your life to both art and music?
That's actually an amazing question because it's always been a struggle. You know, I've always been an artist since my very first memory. It was kind of my identity. I was drawing since, you know, I was two or whatever. I came to music pretty late. I started playing guitar when I was 16. And for years, just kind of struggled with, for lack of a better word, the importance of one discipline over the other. Like, is art better than music? Is music better than art? You know what I'm saying? Like, I just couldn't know where
tough
to...
Tough choice, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Where I've kind of landed is the universality of music. You know, music is universal. Kind of speaks to its power, mm-hmm. to me.
Who are some of your influences for your art and your music? Who are you inspired by?
Mostly just painterly painters. I like Nia Rausch's work a lot. He's kind of a contemporary painter. But Monet, you mentioned, I love him. Mm-hmm. John Singer Sargent, I like. Dali is a huge influence. Gerhard Richter is a pretty powerful painter. You know, like, it kind of runs the gamut, you know.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Amy? Who inspires you? Obviously, your dad is a huge influence on you, but
graphically.
Are there artists that you look at and think, wow, that's who I want to be like?
Yeah. My favorite, I guess, would be, there's so many. but I really like the futurists. They have bad rap often. But I like the idea of portraying movement through a stagnant plane as much as possible because there's just so much opportunity there. And I love Henry Darger, who also gets a bad rap. But I like that he had this sort of hermetic approach to artwork and wrote a very long story that was about his inner world. So,
now, you know, tonight is what we call the First Friday Art Walk. It's in the inner southeast Portland, and there's lots of galleries involved. How important it is for either end or both of you to be involved in that kind of walk, and for KBOO to step up as a new gallery location within that?
I think it's really exciting that you guys are going to be part of that community event. Yeah, I haven't spent that much time in the First Friday Art Walk in a long time, but I think it's a great thing.
You know, something, Amy, when I looked at some of your artwork, which is really awesome, I almost felt like it reminds me of Picasso a little bit in a way, because there's kind of a whimsical quality to it, and yet you get up and you realize what the real image is, and it's kind of horrifying in some cases. You know, it's like this really beautiful picture. Wow, beautiful painting with wonderful, glorious colors. And you get up close and you're like, wow, these are a bunch of refugees running for their lives. Mm-hmm. Or this is a town that has just been bombed. I mean, it's really striking. So this is kind of almost a political statement.
Yeah. Well, I want to draw people in with beauty, mm-hmm. of course. Or not of course, but I like doing that. But also, I think what you're describing is maybe a response to my confusion of feeling a little bit like these, you know, these are my family stories, mm-hmm. and nothing, I don't want to make a polemic, but I want to invite people to learn the story and to empathize. And I don't know if showing grotesque images would do it for me at this point in my artistic life.
So it sounds like you're looking for the emotional response in the watcher, the observer, in the person coming to see your art, that maybe you're not wanting to prescribe what that will be, but you're trying to inspire kind of draw them into an emotional response in interaction to what they're seeing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hoping for empathy and realizing that this is a human story. You know, this is not one culture, one society. It's important to realize, like, to be realistic and not deny that this is happening to a group of people, but that this is something that is important to everyone as a human. I don't know.
Well, hopefully lots of folks are going to come down and see your work in just a few moments. Actually, it's going to start here at KBOO, but in case they can't and they still want to see your work, where can they see your creations? Justin.
Yeah, so my name is Justin Auld, like Auld Lang Syne, and that's my website.
Okay.
I got it before I couldn't. Back in the day, that's what happens, my
it's
actual
been
name.
For a long time, huh?
Yeah.
And Amy?
My website is Amy, A-M-Y, Suha, S-U-H-A, Kutab, K-U-T-T-A-B, .com.
And you are selling some items here tonight?
Yes.
Both of you have your work on sale?
Yeah.
So we really want to invite people to come down and get an opportunity to see this art. You haven't seen it anywhere else recently, right? That's for sure, or ever in terms of some of it. And you're very much welcome to take a look around KBOO at the same time.
That's right. We're so looking forward to having everybody. And these two artists, I think, are just amazing, because their work is not just beautiful to look at, but it's also, they're both kind of think pieces. Amy's and Justin's work. I mean, when you're looking at your work, for example, Justin, you're thinking, what is this image? I see all these kind of dots and dashes and shapes and colors, and what, and do I see a glimmer of, is that a flower or is that a person?
It's up to you, and it really always is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Well, thank you, Justin, and thank you, Amy, for showing up tonight in our studios and for being our first ever artist in the First Friday Art Walk.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for joining us, and you out there as the listeners, come on down.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be right back. listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 7th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Special thanks to Asia Hawthorne tonight. Our engineer is Mike Vitaklis. The interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund. Thank you for listening, and now we leave you to the news.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a former U.S. diplomat to Cuba, Wayne Smith, wrote once that Cuba seems to have the same effect on American administrations that the full moon once had on werewolves. It comes to mind as you hear of National Security Advisor John Bolton denouncing Cuba's, quote, malign influence and ideological imperialism, close quote, to an audience including veterans of the failed Bay of Pigs invasion, no less. And that's the reason, he said, for renewed sanctions on the country, including restrictions on U.S. citizens' ability to travel there. That all could be occasion for the U.S. press to explore the United States' international outlier stance toward Cuba. We'll talk about what's happening with Netfa Freeman of the Institute for Policy Studies. Also on the